Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Molly Hartley, and today we're going to be reviewing The Haunting of Matt Gerundese. It's a pleasure to have you here with us.
We are the Shock Doctors. So yeah, as Matt, or Molly rather, has pointed out, we're taking a break from our usual fare of theatrical horror new releases to go back in time a little while.
Yeah, a little time hop, little throwback Thursday action for you today, if you're listening to this on a Thursday, as fate would have it. We've done this once before with Friend Request, which was only from a few years ago.
Yeah.
This is going back a ways further than that. What those two films have in common is that they're both on Netflix, so ease of access was a factor in our decision making. They're also both meritless schlock, so there's some fun to be had there too.
Yeah, I guess for me, what kind of illustrates how bad The Haunting of Molly Hartley would have to be, even before having watched it, it's the fact that even back in high school, when I watched a bunch of really schlocky horror movies, just grabbing whatever was on the shelves at Blockbuster or Family Video or what have you, I steered clear of this one because I heard it was real bad and just had nothing going for it. And, well,
here we are.
Here we are indeed.
10 years later. 11. Mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this came out when we were in high school, and we both, we'd, I think, seen Cloverfield together at that point, but
yes.
our like horror fanatic odyssey had yet to begin in earnest. But we both independently looked at this movie and were like, pass.
No.
I always get it mixed up with A Haunting in Connecticut, which came out around the same time and which I've to this day never seen. So yeah, it's just kind of, I don't know, it's one of those, you know what you're in for. I'm not going to regurgitate my whole rant from the Possession of Hannah Grace episode about how much I hate this naming convention. I feel like the blanking of first name last name is like, it's genuinely cursed. Like at this point, there's no other way around it. Like it's the kiss of death.
The Autopsy of Jane Doe is the one that comes to mind that is all right
in
recent years.
It is very adequate, and it's the lone outlier in that respect.
Yeah. Well, now that we've kind of spoiled our general opinion on Molly Hartley, Matt, how about you take us through a synopsis?
Sure. Well, I mean, my general opinion hasn't changed since I was 17, and that was just based on instinct and hearsay. So actually watching the damn thing when I'm pushing 30 is kind of just...
It was an exercise in futility.
Yeah. So we open in like a sunny, wooded area with this kind of elaborate promposal kind of thing where... A lady is picking her way through the underbrush, following like a length of twine that kind of extends from tree to tree, and there are messages periodically along the string that
fucking neon-colored sticky notes.
That say, you know, almost there, you know, keep going, follow me, that kind of thing. And she follows the twine to a cabin where a handsome hunk is waiting with a necklace or a bracelet or something. He says, happy birthday. She says, what? It's not even my birthday. And he's like, well, you know, I couldn't wait. I wanted to surprise you. Her dad materializes on the scene.
Out of thin fucking air.
Yeah, with a jump scare accompaniment. Says, you're coming with me, you little hussy. He literally tells her to put some clothes on. Although her attire is seasonally appropriate. Although she very puzzlingly says that she's freezing her ass off at one point, which is just seems like there's a powerful disconnect between what the screenwriter was imagining and what the conditions actually were when the cameras were rolling. So that should have been redressed. But it's the least of this movie's problems. It just kind of lets you know right off the bat that like no one was trying.
Pretty much.
So the father and daughter set out into this bright sunny day. Looks like
bright sunny day.
Looks like a balmy 70 something degrees, and she gets in his truck and they take off, and he starts ranting incoherently about how she's about to turn 18 and he can't let that happen, and may God forgive me, this, that, and the other. And he does a little bit of impromptu off-roading, and they spin out and they survive the wreck, and he grabs a shattered piece of rear view mirror and he proceeds to off his daughter tastefully, I guess, off screen. We just hear some kind of like wet, gushy, like watermelon stabbing Foley work. Cue title drop. Yeah. And that was a prologue set in 1997, by the way.
A mere 11 years ago at the time, and not the eternity that it is now.
Yeah, Jesus. So then we then cut to present day, first year of the Obama administration. simpler times, and we find, I forgot her name, and it's in the fucking title. Molly Hartley.
You called yourself this name.
Yeah, so Matt Gerandese is getting closer and closer to her sweet 18th. And she awakens from a nightmare, which is actually a memory of her being stabbed by her mother. She and her father have recently relocated to another town to try to put all of that bloodshed in the past. So a lot of this movie is comprised of prep school frenemy politics, I would say. Like, there's an awful lot of screen time devoted to her showing up at this new school and making new friends and making new enemies, and I'm like consulting my notes, and I'm hard pressed to remember any of their names. Or
the ratio of that to horror is distressingly high.
I'll say.
Like, this movie, taking out the credits, has a runtime of probably just about 80 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And probably about 50 of those minutes have almost nothing to do with the ostensible premise of the film.
Right. Well, because this movie, and we'll touch on this after the break, this movie obviously wanted to be a kind of thought-provoking slow burn of a thing, but it just totally shits the bed on that front, and indeed almost every other front. So we'll pick up with the next thing that I remember, which is that Molly is in the cafeteria. She's just met, do you happen to know her name, the Jesus freak?
Fuck no.
Okay, she's just been introduced to one of her classmates, who's kind of a Bible thumper, is constantly harping on about the Lord. And she's talking about her profound personal relationship with our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And Molly gets a wicked, nasty headache that my co-host aptly pointed out sounds exactly like the L train screeching to a halt. It's like uncannily, it's just like, it sounds exactly like a subway slamming on the brakes, which is pretty irritating in real life and pretty irritating in an entertainment product too, because it
particularly because it recurs, yeah,
over and over again. Yeah,
I just looked into it. The Jesus freak's name is Alexis, for ease of reference.
Got it. Hannah then subsequently has a meet cute with a guy with a I got it confused with Hannah Grace. Okay. It's a fucking curse, I'm telling you. It's my curse, to be precise. That's why this program is called The Haunting of Matt Gerandese, because I will never be rid of these fucking movies that are all exactly the same, except for this one, which is actually different in some weird and kind of intriguing ways, but we'll get to that shortly. Molly, or whoever, then bumps into a dude with a proto Bieber haircut, this kind of dreamboat love interest guy. Don't remember his name, surprise surprise.
Joseph.
Yeah. So they exchange a little bit of banter, and then I expired on the spot. I just keeled over. Jim, you'll have to soldier on without me. No, I mean, so then the movie settles into a rhythm where Molly keeps having nightmares pertaining to her mother. Her mother is always prattling on about how, you know, I have to save your soul. I'm doing this for your own good, that kind of thing.
There's a little bit of weird tension between Molly and her dad, because she's basically like, my mom tried to kill me, fuck her. And her dad's like, well, she's still your mother and she's still my wife, so, you know, we just gotta hope she gets better.
Right.
I don't want her to get better, she's gonna get out, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, get it, because she's incarcerated in a mental hospital.
Yeah, as opposed to prison.
Just outside of town. Molly has a panic attack episode at school. Once again, it pertains to that old time religion. Her teacher is handing out copies of the Bible because he has inferred that his students don't have a frame of reference for all the Milton stuff that they've been reading. They've been reading Paradise Lost. So they get into a little back and forth where he's arguing with Alexis. Is that right? Alexis is like, I don't feel comfortable reading the Bible in a literature class. It's the truth. It's the word of God. It's not just
a text.
Yeah, right. And this prompts Molly to have a nosebleed, and she runs into the bathroom and starts spasming on the floor. I think she gets jump scared, presumably, by something or other.
She gets jump scared by Leah, who, as far as we can tell, is the resident bad girl in the school. We know this because she wears fishnet stockings and a lot of eyeshadow.
Yeah,
so
she's very like a bowling for soup girl all the bad guys want. I was having some profound like teenage flashbacks every time her character sauntered on screen.
So she like bursts out of one of the stalls and says, you know, you can't hide in here all day. I've tried. Ha ha ha.
Right.
Wanders off.
So then Molly meets with the school's guidance counselor, who has a file on her mother, which she is unsealing and saying, like, you have to address this. You can't avoid it forever. Your mother is very sick, but you should make an effort to understand the nature of the beast, the nature of her illness.
Because it can be hereditary.
Yes, exactly. And Molly just basically wants nothing to do with it. Later that night, she has another episode at home this time, but once again in the bathroom. That's where she goes to...
knowing...
Spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Knowing how films are shot for budgetary reasons, I'm just imagining that they shot all of these bathroom sequences in succession,
and she just had to spend an entire shooting day, like, bleeding from the nose and thrashing around.
In the same bathroom.
It's better than reading this dialogue, frankly. At least then you get a little bit of artistic license, a little bit of wiggle room. I did a funny without meaning to. And then she wakes up in a hospital, an ambulance, and then she's hospitalized, and they find some kind of nasal tumor. It sounds like a joke. It isn't. They find like some kind of blood clot in her nose. And there's a fancy name for it.
Yeah, some kind of tumor in her sinuses that's, in theory, putting like a bunch of pressure on her brain, which is causing headaches, auditory hallucinations, blurred vision, nosebleeds, basically all of her symptoms.
Yeah, and to the filmmaker's credit, this is the first horror movie that has actually found a plausible medical explanation for constant nosebleeds. I feel like nosebleeds are the hackiest like shortcut to saying like, oh, this character is about to die or explode or go nuts or like anything. Basically, is that a nosebleed is always a harbinger of doom. But here it's actually kind of accounted for. It's not interesting, but it's like it's actually the explanation is so banal that it's kind of interesting, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So they get that taken care of. She goes under the knife. They get that mass of whatever out of her nose. And she's good for like the next 30 to 40 minutes. Like it, well, like the hallucinations.
The movie's not that long.
Well, it felt like
it's the next like 15 or 20. But yeah, she goes through a period where she's just fine.
Yeah, the hallucinations appear to have been pretty much entirely alleviated.
She gets tighter with Leah for a little while. She also gets visited in the hospital by Alexis, who brings her a
I have
devotional
the
Bible for teens.
Good. I'm glad you held on to the title. I wrote it down for posterity just in case. Yeah, no, she brings her a copy of Chicken Soup for the Agnostic Soul, I guess.
But yeah, and then she has a couple of flirtatious encounters with Joseph because, of course.
Mm-hmm. So then she goes out one night to a study group. Unbeknownst to her father, is actually a party at Joseph's place. He's a very well-heeled would-be pickup artist. Apparently, he's got this whole like, it's the prototypical like teen movie party to end all parties kind of party. you know, where like the entire school is there and they're all Abercrombie and Fitch models and the booze is flowing freely. And yeah, it's really took me back to the 90s. So then en route to the party, Molly regales her new best friend,
Leah,
Bowling for Soup, with her tragic backstory and how, you know, her mom went nuts one day, no previous history of mental illness, and stabbed her in the chest and was subsequently put away.
It's like this weird one-upsmanship of, like, shitty backstories, too, because the scene starts with Leah talking about, like, because Molly asks her, like, hey, I saw you in the counselor's waiting room the other day, like, what's up? And Leah's all, oh yeah, I have anger issues, I've found out recently that I'm adopted, you know, my real parents didn't want me, they just gave me up. And then Molly's basically like, oh really, well my mom stabbed me in the chest.
Cracks her knuckles. Yeah. It really is
hold my beer,
kind of a race to the bottom for those two in terms of who's more troubled. But, you know, friendships have been built on shakier foundations than that.
I mean,
at least they have something in common. I want to say Hannah every single time. Molly gets into a dance floor cat fight with Joseph.
Yeah, that's the guy's name.
The guy with Joseph's ex is what I was trying to say.
Who has been sort of flitting around on the margins of this film periodically.
Mm-hmm.
She's in the English class. She's confronted Molly in the hallway a couple of times.
Yeah.
Basically, she's your standard, like, blonde, popular girl, hateful bitch archetype.
Catty, bitchy, vengeful ex character. Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely stock.
And so this character, whose name we're not going to bother to look up, she does exactly what you would expect her to do. She has somehow found out about Molly's backstory, mm-hmm. and is just like calling her a freak.
So
and
the claws come out.
And then she keeps trying to get into it with Molly, and Molly's trying to leave. And then Molly just fucking hulks out and like breaks her wrist.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not graphic. I was really hoping for some like Brundlefly action there. You remember like the arm wrestling in the bar? Yeah. I mean, that's always I don't know. You got to see like a little bit of bone or something in order for a scene like that to have any real impact, because it doesn't look like her arm twists in a way that arms
it twists pretty normally. There's just kind of a gnarly crunching noise.
Yeah, and then she just has to sell the pain with her performance, which it doesn't really come through.
So she flees
to a payphone.
Well, right. First she tries to get Leah to take her home, and Leah's like weirdly bitchy about not wanting to help her, but whatever.
Yeah, it's just another moment where this movie gets bogged down with frenemy politics. It's like, just
in places where it makes even less sense than usual.
Right.
So she just starts running down the street. She tries calling her dad on her cell, but she can't get service because, you know, it's 2008. I guess that sort of thing still happened.
Thanks, Obama.
In places that aren't complete wilderness.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, she makes it to a payphone and calls dad, and dad agrees to come pick her up.
But not before she is attacked by another mom hallucination, which I believe is the first post-surgery mom spat that she's had.
Yeah.
And she loses her shit again, collapses, screaming and wailing and carrying on. And
The
cops show up.
And so does dad.
And my spirit is ebbing.
Keep it together, vision, Matt. You've got the notes right in front of you.
Vision getting hazy. Right. Okay. So then some stuff must have happened. I assume it was like teen drama that I just didn't write down, because then my next note is like it. So then Molly gets attacked at home in a bathroom. Again, go figure. It's where this character goes to be imperiled by her actual flesh and blood mother, who has escaped from the sanitarium.
Yeah, with the assistance of some nurse, apparently,
who
believes me.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
you know.
Right. And what she believes, this is where we get our big exposition dump, is that on the day of Molly's birth, she was fatally premature. It was like a miscarriage in a truck stop bathroom or something. And she was going to die. And then a spooky witch Really, like, yeah, she's not done up with like Hansel and Gretel garb, but she, you know, like a straight up Satanist, approaches them in the bathroom and gives them a Faustian bargain, which is that she can restore life to their stillborn, provided that she surrender her soul on her 18th birthday.
Now, it's very important for the twist later that we actually never see the Satanist's face.
Yes, yeah.
During this sequence.
Crucially, yes, you're absolutely right. So Molly seems at first, as you'd expect, massively incredulous, just not buying it. She throws her mother over
the banister.
Over a railing, yeah. And she falls, I think, to her death. It was in self-defense. Her mother was coming at her with another sharp
I think
implement.
It was another pair of scissors.
I think, yeah, that seems to be the weapon of choice. Dad comes home, finds this bedlam, and tries to talk some sense into Molly, who has now changed her tune rather abruptly, I thought, and is now being like, you've been lying to me. You know, that now she's taking her mother's word as gospel, essentially, and I use that word advisedly. She believes that she's doomed, that she's cursed, that she's, I don't know, it's never spelled out in plain English exactly what the stakes are in this scenario. And I should also mention, at this point, we are on the eve of her 18th birthday. It is mere hours away.
Yeah. And there is to this point still no definitive confirmation that this is anything more than hereditary mental illness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which the can be interesting, but is definitely not in this case.
Yeah. A movie that did that better is, go figure, Hereditary. You know, I mean, I think that there's almost any movie that's dealt with that issue did it better than The Haunting of Matt Jarendaisy. There's no ambiguity.
So Molly's dad basically wants to get her to a doctor because she's starting to lose it, clearly. Mm-hmm. And so she hauls off and hits him in the head with some kind of hefty stone statuary of some kind.
Yeah, she brains him. And
brains him real good. Doesn't kill him, fortunately, but that was just kind of an abrupt turn. And she runs out of the house and into downtown, wherever, small town place they're living.
Yeah, she's going to solicit help from
Alexis.
Alexis, thank you. And Alexis says, okay, I can give you protection.
Because she's been trying to save her soul, obviously, at least as early as the devotional Bible for teens.
Every time she's on screen. I thought I was going to get a nosebleed in real life and a shrieking L headache just from hearing her talk about the blood of the lamb or whatever.
And initially, Alexis thinks that this is just the beginning of a gradual conversion. Molly will get indoctrinated into Christianity and all this, but Molly wants some instant relief.
Clock's ticking. I need one of those like 24-hour Vegas wedding style. Like, it's like a deathbed conversion, basically. So she needs to be baptized on the quick.
Alexis volunteers to undertake this baptism. Takes, I guess, has access to a chapel.
Yeah.
When no one's there. And takes her into the baptism pool, the dunking booth, mm-hmm. as it were.
Yeah.
And
Dunks her.
And then brings her up. And Molly asks, you know, oh, is that it? And that's when we get a twist that's kind of interesting, but executed so ineptly. And Matt's going to explain
why. It's my favorite line in the entire movie. Alexis is staring down at her with a kind of complicated expression on her face. And she says, do you know where my grandmother's a nurse? Let me run that by you one more time. Do you know where my grandmother's a nurse?
We didn't even know she had a grandmother who was alive. We knew nothing about her.
Yeah, I really don't.
Apparently, she is a nurse. Also, she is a nurse at a particular place.
Yeah, and she helped Molly's mother fly the coop, basically, because they're both fundamentalist Christians, and I guess that she just was very susceptible to that kind of satanic panic talk.
Yeah. So she then proceeds to dunk Molly again, this time attempting to do so for keeps.
Mm-hmm. she's going for the gold.
And Molly gets the upper hand, kind of throws Alexis off of her. Alexis hits her head in another kind of gruesome crunching noise with no visible gore.
Yeah, a lot of head trauma in this movie, but bloodless head trauma.
Head trauma. And Molly runs off.
Mm-hmm.
And she runs into Joseph, who's just driving around in his pickup truck like he always is.
Yeah, it's kind of the only way that they ever interact is by colliding. It's like that's a cliche of meet cutes, right? That the man and the woman will literally bump into each other in a crowd. But it seems like every time they cross paths, it's like this time he almost hits her with a car. It's like it escalates every single time, which it occurs to me could be a really funny gag in like a Not Another Teen Movie-esque spoof, but here it doesn't seem intentional. It's just every time he comes on screen, it's just a little bit contrived.
Yeah.
So she's at her wit's end, and he takes her back to his place.
We get a scene interspersed here where Leah goes to Molly's house to inquire after her. Molly's dad has regained consciousness and is kind of holding his head as he stumbles over to the front door, takes a birthday gift that Leah has purchased for Molly.
Yeah, trying to bury the hatchet, I guess, trying to make nice.
And Leah's like, is Molly okay? And her dad's like, no, I think she's fine. Do you have any idea where she is? And so...
Father of the year.
Even though this is all building toward a climax and Leah is looped into the climax here, we never actually see her again.
No, that's true.
Kind of weird.
God, that is weird. Its weirdness will become more apparent as we plow through the climax here. So Molly, Hannah, whoever, has texted the guidance counselor being like, hey, I'm spiraling. I could use some advice.
Joseph has gone in because they've gone to his house. He's got some story about how his dad has a safe full of money and they're just going to take some or all of it and run away together.
Mm-hmm.
But Joseph has gone in ahead, I guess presumably because the idea was that Molly didn't need to go inside at all. But he gets inside and then we just hear a weirdly unconvincing, like, Molly!
Oh, I completely forgot about that. Yeah, so she goes
in to look around.
To investigate.
We see some weird, shifty shadows. We don't really know what to make of it. She goes out to... I can't tell whether it's like a separate building, like a guest house,
like a greenhouse almost. It's
right.
Got all glass exterior.
Anyways, she finds him in there and he's got pretty standard, like small cake with a single candle in it. Like, you know, happy birthday. Even though he's got this big ass fucking knife sitting next to it. Mm-hmm. That's not ominous or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is when we get the pretty boy's heel turn, which I wasn't sure that they were going to do. I anticipated the next shoe that dropped, which is then that the guidance counselor comes in behind her and Molly's like, oh, you got my text. What text?
Yeah. It's at this point that we find out not only is Joseph the
Chad.
The Chad. Brah. not only is he a culty guy, but we discover that the guidance counselor is as well. And not only that, but she is in fact the very same woman who offered the Faustian bargain to Molly's parents in the mm-hmm. first place, which is kind of weird just in a casting sense because the woman looks like she's maybe in her late 30s, and so that means she's like playing an integral role in a cult when she's in her like late teens.
Yeah, it just makes the whole cult seem like way more, it's like a family-owned operation. It's like very intimate. It's not... I don't know. I always prefer when sinister organizations in movies, Illuminati bullshit, is more
sprawling,
far-reaching in its implications. Yeah, not this mom and pop cult bullshit.
So there's a lot of like weird talk about you're going to become so powerful and why don't you want this and what has God ever done for you? Blah blah blah. A lot of like religious talk. While at the same time, the movie's like, this is the only time where it's been vaguely interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, the one time, excuse me, I take that back a little bit. The one time before this where this movie got a little bit of a, reaction out of me was when, as stupidly as the twist was administered in terms of that clunky, awful piece of dialogue, when we find out that Alexis the Jesus freak is going to try and drown Molly, I was like, okay, I'm on board.
I mean, it's a left turn.
But
sure. It's a curveball.
Other than that, the only time this movie gets vaguely interesting is around this time.
Yep.
When it's like, oh, cool, the guidance counselor is a Satanist after all. And look, so is the love interest. Okay, this is all interesting, but it's also like mired in all of this hokey, rote, God isn't so great sort of.
Yeah, it's not exactly. It's not exactly Milton, let me tell you. like it's like I rolled my eyes when like Al Pacino shows up in Devil's Advocate and calls himself John Milton. But like Devil's Advocate is Shakespearean compared to this. It's like way. It's night and day.
Yeah. So it's at this time after we have a lot of this again nonsensical dialogue that some cultists bring in Papa Hartley, and the guidance counselor gives Molly a choice. Like, oh, well, you made a pact, and the only way you can get out of it, maybe God will let you get out of it if you kill your father.
Yeah, she frames it in the most cagey way you could possibly. It's like so slippery. There's no, yeah, it's really odd. So the idea is that Molly's going to murk her dad. He's raising the knife over her head.
Clock and he's on board. He's like, no, just do it. Just go on, do it, do it.
Clock is chiming midnight, and she stabs herself in the heart.
Which provokes the best line reading from her dad, which was, no! No, 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 no!
It sounds like revving a chainsaw. It's not the... I have a hard time believing that was their best take.
Right. The stab is curiously bloodless, and at first we thought that's just because nothing in this movie is bloody except noses.
Yeah, exactly. So it just looked like another flub until she goes for it a second time.
And once again, no blood. And it's like, oh, it's because it's midnight, and now she's the Antichrist or
I
whatever.
I guess, yeah. Like they never use that word. They never... I don't think they ever even really call her, like, the Chosen One. Like,
or it seems anything.
Like if anything, the prologue... would seem to indicate, like from 1997, would seem to indicate that this has happened before, and in fact maybe happens semi-regularly.
Yeah,
that this is how they absorb new members into this coalition of theirs, whatever it is. But yeah, no, I guess that this is a pretty big deal. It sure doesn't feel like it.
Yeah, no, and it's made even less of a big deal because the film very abruptly fades to black.
Yeah.
And then and then it comes up, and again, this is a very shitty movie that had like this brief glimmer of, okay, yeah, this cult is vaguely interesting. Look, the guidance counselor, etc. Yeah,
I have nothing more to say. This ending is absolute hogwash. Just please take over.
Yeah. So it's a graduation ceremony for Molly's high school, and she has been named valedictorian, so she's giving the speech, obviously, and just the ending of this, the way it's shot, the way line deliveries are, it just feels like the
music,
end.
Though!
Which, I'm sorry. Don't spoil it!
I'm sorry.
It feels so much like the end of any, like, high school, either rom-com or slob comedy, because they all, like, end the same way.
Uh-huh. At least from that era, yeah.
Yeah, and then, to top it off, this, like, upbeat pop rock anthem.
This,
you know,
is the story of a girl. It's not literally that song, but it
quite,
might as well be.
But close.
It's very close.
It just starts building up and segues into the credits, and she's got like a wink wink encounter with the guidance counselor as she and Joseph are walking away at the end, and credits roll.
It just turns into Legally Blonde, like, out of nowhere, and I can't imagine why. Like, it's obviously supposed to be subversive. Like, her valedictorian speech has some would-be sinister undertones about how we're the generation that's gonna change the world, you know, we're gonna, that's knowing that she's apparently Satan spawn.
The only way this ending works with that tone, if it's trying to be subversive, is if the entire movie, it's like if she knew she was the Antichrist the whole time and the whole movie was like a satire.
Yeah.
That's the only way this ending would play.
Right.
Otherwise, it's one of the worst cases of tonal whiplash I've ever seen, because there's this very solemn, like, I've tried to stab myself to save the world.
Yeah.
Fade to black. Fade right. It's not even a slow fade. No. For God's sake.
No.
And it comes right back up, and then it's just this nonsense.
Yeah, you're right. It would have to be a much broader satire in order to justify that music choice.
Yeah,
it is utterly harebrained.
Anyway, we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll come back with some more of our thoughts afterwards. Back in a moment.
Mom?
Honey, come pray with me. Pray
with me. I have sin.
Close your eyes. I can save you.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at ShockDoctorsPod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Dad, I need you to come pick me up.
Are you safe?
Yeah, I'm safe.
I'm leaving right now.
The darkness is coming for you.
Molly! Let me save you! Mom!
And we're back. So, Matt, we already kind of unloaded pretty well on this movie, but what else you got?
Oh, what else have I got? Yeah, I just feel like it's a curse. You know, it's just so I feel like I haven't watched it. I may never get around to watching it. I mean, I joke that I'm going to live forever and watch everything, you know, just given enough time. I probably would end up watching everything. But there's a movie that just came out some weeks or months ago called The Haunting of Sharon Tate. That is a front runner for worst of 2019 by all accounts. And I just hope that maybe, like, if that movie doesn't put this trope to bed, this titling convention, then it's evergreen. It'll just be around forever. It can't be killed. I'm so sick of it.
Yeah.
It's why I can never tell any of these movies apart. It's why I kept wanting to call Molly Hannah. you know, it's just, yeah, it's just such a, it's just such a fucking Mad Lib, you know, it's such a, like, the blanking of first name, last name, it's, you know, it's just, it's so low effort. I don't know who it appeals to. I don't know who looks at that and isn't immediately turned off. It just makes me feel like a rat being drip fed, you know, like the same crap over and over again. It's like a lab mouse or something.
We complain about how all of the James Wan movies kind of bleed together because it's a similar bag of tricks. All the demons look the same, etc. But at least the titles are different.
Yeah, we can say that for them. Yeah, that is very true.
The titles aren't even necessarily that good, but they are different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I should also, if it's not clear, the James Wan universe is not as execrable as this film. Not by a long shot.
No, it isn't.
I don't want to do a disservice to Mr. Wan.
No, this movie has between one and three good things in it, as near as I can tell. I kind of liked, during the climax, there's a couple shots of shadowy figures pressed up against the glass. I said before that it kind of looks like they're in a greenhouse. So you've got like a bunch of other cultists kind of closing in, forming a periphery around the birthday celebration. and that was kind of neat looking. It's not integrated into the sequence, editorially speaking, in a very appealing way, but it's not a bad shot. There's not that many good shots, so the good ones tend to stand out.
Speaking of things not being edited in a particularly effective way, I'm not one typically to call out editing. And I think a big part of that is just the nature of editing. Usually when it's good, it's invisible.
Right.
And even when it's not great, I usually just like, okay, whatever.
You can kind of take it in stride. Yeah.
But when the editing of something becomes truly execrable, it cannot fail to escape my notice.
Yeah.
And in general, this movie, it's fine editing-wise, but as far as Papa Hartley is concerned, every time he appears, it's almost like a smash cut. The first time I remember this happening is Molly is flirting with Cult Boy, who we do not yet know is Cult Boy, walking with Joseph in the halls, and she's just been invited to the party she ends up going to. And she and Joseph are walking down the hall, and very abruptly, there's just this cut to like a close-up of Dad.
And he's like 2 inches from her face. It's wacky as anything.
It's just like, hey. And then not only is that cut bad, but the next cut is also bad because it's on his face for about a half a second. Exactly as long and no longer as it takes for him to get out the word hey before it cuts right back to her and Joseph being like, oh shit.
Yeah, he kind of looks like another hallucination, actually. Like it's actually more jarring than any of the mom visions that Molly has throughout the film. Yeah, he's always materializing like that. A similar thing happens during the climax when, like, boom, all of a sudden Dad's there being held captive. Actually, I say all of them, there's only two. There's Papa Hartley, and then there's the father from the prologue. But both of them are, like, just cock-blocking robots, I guess. It's like they were put on this earth to just appear anytime their daughters were on the verge of coming into their sexuality or, like, talking to a boy for too long, you know? And then they just, like, I don't know. If there was a puff of smoke, it would be like a Harry Potter thing. Like, they're literally being magically summoned.
They're apparating.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you.
Yeah, it's almost to the point where the haunting of Molly Hartley is actually just her being haunted by her father.
Yeah.
Stopping her from having sex.
There is actually, just because in the prologue and then in the narrative proper, the whole thing is to do with how you can't let your daughter turn 18. That gives this whole movie this air of weird paternalism. That,
yes.
Like, this like overprotective, territorial kind of thing that reminded me of like disgruntled, overprotective father memes that you see on like Facebook. Like 11 rules for dating my daughter. Rule number one: I have a shotgun. That kind of trash.
Yeah,
you know, it was like the movie never really gets away from that.
No, and I mean, obviously, it falls into the broader category, kind of horror staple of female development and sexuality being a scary thing, kind of.
Yeah, normally it's more like the onset of puberty that's
right.
Supposed to do it, or like you're the first time you menstruate or something like that.
Carrie,
that feels like it has
obviously.
more of a totemic thing to it. I mean, it's still nonsense, but 18 just feels so arbitrary. It's like, yeah, okay, she can join the army now, but
she can buy a lottery ticket.
Don't get it twisted, fam. I'm not she is of age. She is legal in the pornography sense of the word, and you know, don't misconstrue this as like me talking about how the age of consent is arbitrary, because that's not what I mean at all. I just mean that, like, for the purposes,
in a
horror sense, 18 does not carry a lot of weight. Yeah, it seems like they settled on it because it has to do with like societal taboos that really have nothing to do with what this movie is actually about. I actually wish that this movie had leaned more into the whole overprotective dad can't let my sweet little girl come of age thing, because that could be scary if they were doing it on purpose, but I feel like they just stumbled into it sideways, given the nature of the material.
Yeah.
The nature of the material actually could have been this movie's saving grace. I like the idea of a young woman being haunted by her past and having a violently adversarial relationship with her mother. The fact that Molly's biggest fear is that her mother will break out of the nut house and come murder her in her bed or in a bathroom. Let's be real. It's the only place these things ever happen, in this movie at least. Yeah, I mean that could be really scary. I have a kind of a Achilles heel for, it's gonna sound weird, for like homicidal women, like women slashers. I feel like you don't see a lot of them, and maybe it's the novelty that kind of does it for me, or maybe it's some kind of weird like Freudian castration phobia thing. I don't know. I don't claim to understand it.
It's either novelty or something we'll have to consult your psychologist about.
Yeah, exactly. My guidance counselor, who's actually a Satanist, will have to have a sit down with me about it. Yeah, no, I mean, I find knife wielding women almost automatically scarier than men, and it's a little bit of a mystery to me. Maybe I have some hangups, but this movie fumbles that ball.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it's a damn shame.
Yeah, Mrs. Hartley is never scary, not even a little.
Yeah, well, it's funny because there are so many hallucination scenes involving her trying to take her daughter's life that when she actually shows up in the flesh, you kind of have a been there, done that feeling, even though this time it's happening for real. Like, it doesn't have any more weight.
Yeah,
than any
feel
of the
any different.
Yeah, exactly, and that's a huge failing, I think.
Yeah, the Fong's gonna be a little bit pedantic,
please.
But yeah, that's our specialty. I take issue with the title of the film.
Well, you think the word haunting is just picked out of a hat, basically?
It's picked out of a hat.
Yes,
you're
right.
It has no attachment to what this movie is actually about. It occurred to me while Matt was talking about how Molly's a young woman who is haunted by her past, but that doesn't mean she is literally being haunted.
Well, it's the same thing with Haunting of Sharon Tate. I think they just picked it because it looks good on a family video shelf, you know, like the
right.
the kind of people who watch these movies and aren't like asshole film snob pedants like us, the people who actually enjoy these movies. I think they must like seeing the same words and the same title schemes over and over because they take comfort in the familiarity. I don't know, but like it's working for somebody, or they would stop doing it.
Right.
But I agree, haunting for my purposes is just, that word is a total misfire. It just isn't, it's just NA, not applicable.
Yeah, like Haunting in Connecticut. I also have not seen it, but
yeah,
as far as I know,
Nebraska,
it is definitely
enough
about a haunted house.
Yeah.
There are ghosts or what have you. And here, there's no possession. There are no demons. The only thing supernatural about this movie is at the end when she has reached her 18th birthday and can stab herself and not get injured.
Yeah, which I, you know, if I'd had a pass at this script, there's a lot of things I would have changed, but I would have done away with that for sure, because I feel like the fact that it is the only supernatural, like indisputably supernatural thing that happens, it kind of feels like one too many, because it's such an anomaly.
Right.
When Molly is running for the payphone after she brundle flies that girl at the party, she runs past a movie theater and the marquee says The Tenant, which is a Roman Polanski movie from the 70s. It is the third in a loose trilogy of movies about paranoia, about fear of the neighbors, basically. It's Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, and The Tenant. This movie, that is to say, The Haunting of Matt Gerandese, has much more to do with Repulsion,
yeah,
and Rosemary's Baby, insofar as it's about Satanists and a plot, a satanic plot, cultists, what have you, and also a young woman whose conflicts have to do with her emerging sexuality or some kind of repression, or, you know, so it really has very, it has next to nothing to do with The Tenant, but the reason that that title is up on the marquee is to let the film savvy audience members, the exact kind of people who are bound to hate this movie.
It's like, maybe you shouldn't hate it. We made reference to Polanski.
which just makes me double down on my ire, because now the bad movie is getting highfalutin on me.
It's getting highfalutin, and it's not even doing it right.
Right. Well, and what it's supposed to clue you into the fact that this movie was intended to be a Polanskian thing, a psychological character study, slow burn, is she, isn't she crazy kind of movie, rather than a piece of disposable schlock about the devil getting up to no good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just, so in Rosemary's Baby, I like that the devil worshippers in that movie are kind of pedestrian. They're just wearing like street clothes, and they seem kind of middle American and kind of quaint, because that whole movie is built around the idea that like the people next door are not what they seem, and so their normalcy is part of what makes them frightening, at least in theory. And if not, then it still works as camp, I would argue. But here, you would have to go into this movie with a profound fear of Satan to be scared by any of these people, like the guidance counselor or the Chad or any of them, really. I mean, those are the only ones that we really meet face to face, because their credentials just aren't established. We don't know what their goals are or what they really just don't do anything especially evil. Even at the end when she's giving her valedictorian speech, it's not like there has to be some kind of, there's just no storm clouds on the horizon, literally or metaphorically. It's another beautiful day when they all throw their caps in the air. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. Yeah, I just, in real life, Satanists are kind of obnoxious, but they're pretty chill, you know, and there's no reason to believe that the devil worshippers in this movie are any different. It's just not on screen. You'd have to come into it with your own religious baggage in order for the threat to be at all threatening.
Yeah, there is no indication beyond the fact that now she's all powerful and can stab herself for fun what exactly Molly has been groomed for, what she's going to be up to, what it is that's so bad. I guess maybe the screenwriter was hoping that whatever we could imagine would be better than what they would come up with, but unfortunately there's not even enough Satan flavor in this movie to even like start your imagination going. She's just a girl with superpowers.
Yeah, because again, if you're trying to do a Polanski thing, in Rosemary's Baby, you don't see the inside of the bassinet at the end, but you hear all of them wailing about how, you know, look at his eyes, his feet, hail Satan, God is dead. Like, there's a lot of context to kind of get the gears turning in your head. And here,
the context in this movie is a pop rock song.
This is the story of a girl. Yeah, no, it sucks. And it gets bogged down with, on the subject of religious baggage, with all of these. I was kind of taken aback in a good way when the teacher brought in Bibles and distributed them to his students and was like, we're going to talk about this so that we have a working frame of reference for the Paradise Lost readings that we've been doing. And then the Bible thumper gets into it with him, says the Bible isn't just another text, so on and so forth. Like, it's unusual to hear those ideas in a blanking of first name, last name, 18% on the tomato meter kind of movie, you know? So at first I was like, oh, okay, whoever wrote this had some kind of a brain. But then it's a total non-starter. Actually, I mean, there's more of that as the movie goes on, but it never gets any depth whatsoever. It's always very, like, I likened it to Devil's Advocate earlier, but the gulf there is like, I mean, at least in Devil's Advocate, you've got Al Pacino chewing the scenery and screaming at the top of his lungs. And even if the stuff he's saying isn't exactly John Milton, it's a spectacle and there's something to get out of it. Here, it's just kind of droll and a little preachy in weird ways, and a little like, I don't know, all the talk at the end during that interminable climax about fate and free will and God and the devil, it's just,
God never gave you a choice.
It's just, yeah, it's the murkiest sermon ever. It's hard to even, it's like a bad essay. Like, I tutored high school kids, and it's like, I was having, listening to that dialogue, like a please see me after class kind of moment internally. Like, this needs some polish. Your ideas are not coming through. I don't know what you're getting at.
Yeah. Now, The Haunting of Molly Hartley got a sequel. 7 years later, it came out in 2015. It's called The Exorcism of Molly Hartley.
What on earth is that about?
I took a look at IMDb. And it looks like it gets some payoff out of all of this Satan stuff, where basically looks like Molly's been going around murdering some people or something.
Okay.
And she gets locked up in a psych ward, and she starts tormenting.
Jesus Christ, I've seen a trailer for this, and I didn't even remember. Like, well, it's got her goddamn name in the title, and I didn't even make the connection.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
She's tormenting the other patients, and she needs to have an exorcism performed on her. And so, 7 years later, they're finally getting some mileage out of this demonic stuff. The only problem is, The Haunting of Molly Hartley is a shitty movie. The Exorcism of Molly Hartley is a long-delayed sequel to a shitty movie where the lead actress has changed because, fortunately for Hayley Bennett, who plays Molly in the film we've been talking about now, has gone on to get herself a career. You know, she was in an Emily Blunt film, Girl on the Train. She plays the female lead in the Magnificent Seven remake, etc. So she was apparently in no mood to do a sequel to one of her early films, and so they grabbed somebody else. So yeah, the payoff comes, but it's probably in a movie that's somehow even worse than this, and it's not a movie we're going to watch unless, I don't know, somebody pays us or we both lose a bet.
I was going to say, I'm going to live forever and watch everything. I would still rather put that on than The Haunting of Sharon Tate. So it's not at the very bottom of my to-do list.
Just damn close.
Just damn close. Yeah, it's weird going back to 2008 because I say on this show a lot, you know, it wasn't remotely scary. And that's true. I mean, it's not a front. I'm not like being a big strong man about it, pretending that I wasn't scared. If I say that, it's because a movie didn't work for me. But most of these are current releases. We're seeing them in a theater. The art of jump scares has been refined since 2008.
Yeah.
And this movie is unmistakable proof of that fact, because even the most clumsy, inept jump scare will still occasionally rattle your bones in a movie theater, because you're in a dark room and it's fucking deafening. Like, you know, they crank it all the way up. And in this movie, it's like,
oh, that was supposed to be a jump scare.
Yeah, exactly. I felt like an alien watching, like, Human Entertainment and trying to, like, reverse engineer what pleasure they were supposed to derive from it. The jump scare noises, the reverb on them goes on way too long. Like, sometimes it persists into, like, the dialogue, the ensuing, the relief moment when there's been a fake out jump scare, like, oh, you scared me, you asshole, like that kind of thing. Like, they'll be doing that exchange and you'll still hear, like, as it, like, slowly dies down, almost apologetically, like, oh, I'll see myself out.
Yeah.
I know when I'm not wanted.
Yeah, no. Part of what makes schlocky or horror movies not scary for us is that they're just not very good. Part of it is because since we've watched so many horror movies and we do a podcast about horror movies, a lot of it, you know, we're just inured to it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a movie that I could safely say if I had never watched a horror movie of any kind before, and I had watched this when I was 16 or 17,
yeah,
by myself with all the lights off, I might have gotten the vaguest creeping feeling in my spine. That's about it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you know, it wouldn't have worked then. Sure as shit doesn't work now.
Well, this has been The Haunting of Matt Gerandese / Molly Hartley.
Yes.
And therefore, it has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Hartley.
And we will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Haunting of Molly Hartley trailer, uploaded by Watch Movie Previews. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 2nd, and we'll be discussing James Gunn's superhero horror movie, Brightburn. See you then.